Hi, and welcome to the Webster University Geneva podcast. I'm Juliana Sandholm-Bark. I'm assistant professor at Webster University Geneva. I do research on historical and contemporary discourses on art and its value and on the emergent art scene in Switzerland. In addition to teaching courses in art history and current art, I launched Meet the Artist, a public lecture series this past spring. Meet the Artist is a public lecture series during which artists are invited to talk about their scholarly work and their creative process. Lectures are designed to enhance critical, creative, and cross-disciplinary modes of thinking, and the podcast is a way to document this series of lectures. We have just launched our season two this month. We've had three artists on this podcast already. To access the Meet the Artist event dates and speaker information, please visit the link wcci.webster.ch/events/meet_the_artist. And I'm here today with Rodrigo Figueredo, nom de guerre, hombre radical. Welcome to the podcast, Rodrigo.
Thank you, Juliana.
Rodrigo, you have a fascinating history, and I want to talk about so much, and I hope I have time to raise all the things I want to talk to you about. You were born and raised in Caracas, and in 1994 you moved to Switzerland with your family for political reasons, and you remained in Geneva until 2013, and then you moved to Italy. Mm-hmm. And in this period, you made a lot of music.
Yes.
This was sort of, could you maybe say a little bit about that, the role of music in your life and how you transitioned from music into the visual arts?
Well, I arrived in Geneva when I was 14, 15 years old, and coming from a social and cultural context that was very different. And me as a person, I always had the will to express and produce and create. Mm. And I already drew at the time, but I concentrated all my energy in the audio production and making music, basically. Mm-hmm. I started making hip hop, and it was at the same time, or in real life, in real time, with the development of American hip hop directly, and French hip hop, and Swiss, then the Swiss scene. I was between the second generation. I was within the second generation of developing hip hop artists in Switzerland, of the most important ones. Mm. So the role that music had in my life was that he gave me the experience of. Of producing as in taking means, taking ideas, and taking will and talent and creativity, and passing all those things through a methodology mm-hmm. to end up as in a product. I did it in Switzerland, where it was a place from the, let's say from 98 to 2010, 2012, mm-hmm. where there was in a way it was a context that would help you for creativity, because being confronted to such a different people from different parts of the world, in the international world, was a source of inspiration. Mm. And at the same time, Switzerland had no market, and it wasn't a place specifically where hip hop was born, let's mm-hmm. say that. So it was really hard. Mm-hmm. Being really hard and being the specific conditions, it gave me a set of skills, mm-hmm. A know-how, which when I translated or transposed it to art, pictorial art, painting, it helped me evolve really fast, mm-hmm. because I had a base of know-how, specifically, for instance, to give an example, with social networks and new technology, of marketing my work and being pertinent or being adapted to the way that you have to present and market your work to be heard or seen mm-hmm. In the world as an artist. Mm-hmm.
So how did you go from using the vocabulary of music to using visual language and, you know, becoming born as a visual artist per se?
Well, in hip hop, I used to use a lot metaphors, and also care about message. Mm-hmm. So that is the common denominator, even if the form is very different. You know, one form is heard and the other form is seen. Mm. But basically, the fact as I was saying before, the methodology. I mean, knowing that you have to post a certain way, you have to share a certain way, what words to use, and then passing from words to image, it's the same in the sense that I always cared and still care to pass a message. Mm-hmm. And the form, it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
If it's oral or pictorial.
Mm-hmm. And in 2014, which is a bit of a watershed year for you and for Venezuela as a country, you painted the now very famous and iconic painting, Batalla, a piece that depicts the student protests in Venezuela. And this artwork got published on the BBC's website and was called, I quote, one of the most representative drawings of the events of 2014. And it won an award, the International Alfonso Grassi Art Prize. And at the same time that year, you became a wanted militant artist by the Venezuelan regime, mm-hmm. given your role in social media and human rights and the active political life you were leading as an artist. And mm-hmm. so 2014 really sounds, I mean, looking at this biography, this is taken from your website, you probably recognize the words. This is a really important year for you. Is this the year that you were born as an artist, you would say, as a visual artist?
It's definitely the year where I got consecrated, mm-hmm. or fixated or sure, mm-hmm. that that was the path and that my work was starting to be at a point where I was getting to where I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Well, I always had the leitmotif or the back idea of living from what I create myself. Mm. 2014 was the year, in a sense, and it's also actually the second year I was in the south of Italy, and I went to the south of Italy to give myself the means to take a shot at being an artist. Mm-hmm. A plastic artist, mm-hmm. because I had finished my period as a musician and I achieved the goals I thought I wanted to achieve. Mm-hmm. I wanted to achieve during that period, and that 2014 build up clearly was the beginning of the build up of the art, of the militant artist that you're talking to right now. Mm-hmm. Yes, and Venezuela. Because it's my country of origin, and it's always had a predominant place in my auto-definition of identity. And I have empathy, and I have family there, and it's a subject and a cause that really is determinant in my character. Mm. And it was also the year that I found out that I could assemble mm-hmm. all my different interests, which are creation, communication, passing a message mm-hmm. into one activity. Mm-hmm. And it's not only the fact of painting itself, mm-hmm. but it's also on how you expose it, how you communicate it, what means you use. And obviously I used to the fullest the new technologies, mm-hmm. which I would had not necessarily been effective if I didn't had the prior experience that, for instance, music gave me.
Mm-hmm. So about this 2014 painting that you became now iconic, do you ever feel like it's hampering your style, that it's being too invasive of you moving forward as an artist? You know how it's sort of become so large, so larger than life. Do you ever feel like it's hampering your style, that it's, you know,
that it sets me on a particular direction?
Yeah, that it sort of pushes you to do more of the same rather than maybe developing in a new direction, you know?
Yes and no, because at the end of the day, the idea is that as an artist, you have to start to look out for the setting or the creation or the fixing of an identity. Mm-hmm. It's when you see a Picasso, you know it's a Picasso. When you see a Van Gogh, you know it's a Van Gogh. So in a way, that is part of that type, that piece in particular, Batalla, is very muralesque, like a Diego Rivera murales. Mm-hmm. but not completely. And Bataille itself is also a sum of different types of inspiration. I have, being a multicultural artist, I have inspirations coming from very different sources, from Japanese art to DC comics, to American comic books, mm-hmm. to pop culture, mm-hmm. to 80s pop culture, to classic art. Mm-hmm. And it's normal that in 2015, 2010, in the beginning of the 21st century, that you have eclectic and heterogenic sources of inspiration.
Right.
So does it push me to only do one type of art? Not really. I have two or three directions, mm-hmm. Styles or periods also. Artists, we have also periods. Mm-hmm. And it's not mutually exclusive that I make a painting like Bataille and then I make a painting in stencil or a more figurative or a more abstract. Mm-hmm. And because one is known doesn't necessarily push you to continue mm-hmm. or to hinder yourself to do just what works. Mm-hmm. It's not, obviously, the idea is to make your art work, and defining work it's also something that we could talk a lot about. It's is it your artworks when you are in a museum or when mm-hmm. you're viral, or sometimes there are artworks in museums that are not viral, sometimes there are artworks that are viral that are not in the museum.
Right.
So it works for that particular part of my dynamic. Mm. But if I want to make a more intimate painting on a subject that is more personal, I will make it. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I will, okay, I'm not going to paint titties because I have to paint only serious. I will paint titties. Mm.
Can we talk about virality a little bit? So let's talk about the rise of you as a viral artist. Mm-hmm. This is a relatively new phenomenon. You use social media, you use other means to achieve global world domination, I was going to say.
To achieve exposure, yeah.
Exposure. And so how did you do it? Let's go back to the very beginning of when you were becoming more of an established presence online, and how did you, could you trace back the very beginning yeah. of that?
I'm going to use Bataille as an example. Mm-hmm. I painted Bataille and suddenly I published it on my Facebook account. I think at the time I had maybe something like 3,000 followers mm-hmm. in 2014. And suddenly I saw that the anonymous Venezuela account published it, mm-hmm. and they downloaded the image, they uploaded it again, and they made a tweet. Now, anonymous Venezuela account has a million followers, mm-hmm. so that obviously gives you a lot of exposure, mm-hmm. and exponentially, mm-hmm. People will start using. The image, they would use it as their profile images, mm-hmm. they would make their tweets using the image, and that would push another marginal person to use it because he saw it from somebody else. Mm-hmm. So once that anonymous Venezuela would share my piece, mm-hmm. I would use the argument that anonymous Venezuela would share my piece mm-hmm. to convince other big accounts. Mm-hmm. And then the snowball was big enough to roll by itself. Mm-hmm. That's the way I used it. So in a specific way, so how does it work specifically? Mm-hmm. When an image happening, something happens, and there's an image about that happening that becomes viral, that mm-hmm. becomes something that everybody's talking about and mm-hmm. very shared, very retweeted, very liked. Depending on the social network you're using, mm-hmm. then I would identify the image, and I would make the art version of the image. So I would take the image and do it in my style, mm-hmm. and publish it really close to the moment of emission of the image. So if the image was very viral, I would paint it in 2-3 hours and mm-hmm. publish 3-4 hours afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I would still ride the viral wave. Mm-hmm. It would retroalimentate because people would share the image original, but they would also share the artsy version of it. Mm-hmm. So I would use even the need of individual people for narcissistic things. Okay, I wanna get a lot of likes. Oh, so that image is very viral and everybody's getting likes because everybody's sharing that image. But I just found this art version of the same image. Mm. I'm going to be original. I'm going to get more likes. So I'm going to share the artsy version. Mm-hmm. And that was the way I did it. So I played on human behavior mm-hmm. as an individual. And then a lot of individuals together, they create a trend. And the trend re-affects on the individual. Mm-hmm. It's just knowing how to get in the rolling ball.
Right. So this is a part of your creative process. Then
absolutely.
Ultimately, it's about the selection of those images that you want to reuse.
Yeah.
So would you say you're kind of a collaborator with photojournalists who are working out there and you sort of use their work and
exactly.
reincarnate them or consecrate them in your own way and participate in the increase in exposure of these images, or I don't know, you sort of recycle them. You recycle these images, which give them even more power, right? So you can almost think of yourself as somebody working in a team.
Yeah, and also, yeah. Also, people would used to say this about the pieces or the images is that I would give nobility to the right. happening.
So like something more
than just the picture, the mm-hmm. photograph, mm-hmm. Doing it in art. Hmm. Would add a dimension to it okay. That will become that be, made it become a cultural object, and that was a part that was important. And not only did I in a way took the input from the wave mm-hmm. and made it into an individual production or creation that then was appreciated by the group.
Right.
But it was also the group affecting the way that the piece was done, because mm-hmm. I remember when I was doing these pieces, like Batalla or in 2017, Bravo Pueblo, mm-hmm. I would also ask the people, who do you think is worthy to be in the painting?
Right.
And people would suggest, okay, paint this guy or paint this guy. Mm. Sometimes it's simply just too obvious that it's that the actor. Another example: there was a woman who stopped a tank in the protests in Venezuela, right. and it looked really much like a modern Tiananmen.
Yeah.
That was so obvious that I had to paint it. So yeah. again, and people would say, paint in the piece. She has to be there.
Yeah.
So it was not only coming from me.
Yeah.
It was an aller-retour.
Participatory process.
Yes, absolutely.
Where you sourced individuals.
And Batalla would have never been known to the point that it is mm-hmm. if it wasn't shared a mm-hmm. lot, because the BBC also chose to give. To say that about the piece,
right.
because they researched and they saw millions and millions of shares and retweets, so
yeah,
that gave it okay. So why did you say that this was one of the representatives? Well, look, this guy, this picture has this type of virality, mm. so it goes both ways.
It's amazing this digital era and what it's doing, the impact it's having on the visual arts, on the art market as well. Because you could argue, we were talking about this earlier. That these millions and millions of likes add credibility to a piece.
Absolutely.
Which obviously is happening with your pieces. And so what is the traditional art market? How what is their stance vis-a-vis this new phenomenon of artists acquiring new visibility, credibility, which obviously has to do with the price they attach to their work?
Absolutely.
And what is the art dealer's reaction to this? What is the gallerist's, the auctioneer's?
Well, they have to start adapting.
Point of
but,
view.
But the first mm-hmm. reaction was actually of defense, because the way I did it, it's also very bottom up, mm-hmm. Because I was not able to easily have access to the biggest galleries, the biggest curators, the bigger collectioners, or the auction houses, mm-hmm. which are they function very top down.
Right.
And the breaking of the rules, because you have to be co-invited into this clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, basically, actually, when I was thinking about Anonymous, mm-hmm. when you work with them, you get co-opted. You
right.
don't ask to work with them. It's like when you make your proofs that you're doing an activity or that has an effect on the supraordinated objective,
mm-hmm.
then they call you. Now I'm starting to get called.
Mm-hmm.
So normally to get introduced into the market or the big club, you have to be introduced by doing the traditional path was to be started to be invited to important galleries and then starting to have pieces in great collections or pieces displayed in museums. And then you would get market value from that,
right.
And be known from that. And also the market, people who buy fine art is people, it's a very small percentage of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't need a, they don't care about popular art.
Mm-hmm.
They care about being assured by people who hold the club that this has value.
Right.
So now they understand that there's a shift also. There was also a way of resisting because it's taking away their importance too.
Mm-hmm.
Because the curator or the gallery was the check mark,
mm-hmm.
that would say if you're in this gallery or if a certain curator of a level talks about you, that means that you're good.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can get that you're good with millions of likes,
right.
Without the curator, and that's something that the curator in the gallery is loss of power.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. I met an important art critic in Miami a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
and she came to see my work because I was in a certain gallery.
Mm-hmm.
If I was not in that gallery, she wouldn't even taken me
right.
into account. But she came to see my work. She saw one of my pieces and she said, "Oh, is this a cry piece in the sense of grito,
like a battle cry?"
Yeah, like
mm-hmm.
a battle cry. And I said, "Obviously, it's a piece where you can see a guy with an Anonymous with his arm up and stuff like that."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Okay, it's not bad. It's good. But if you want to do a cry battle piece that is really cutting edge today,"
mm-hmm.
And she talked to me about an artist that I remember the name, that she had made an installation, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a room with 12 chairs, empty chairs,
mm-hmm.
and that was a piece of art. And she was saying to me that that evokes the fact that people who could be there, but they're not there. And it's
right.
like, so I was like, yeah, okay, I understand your concept art, I understand it. But my answer was, yeah, but my piece is popular.
Mm-hmm.
So my piece is popular. My piece was produced by a bus. It's known by millions of people. It's been published by the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And she answered, and this will tell you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Yeah, okay, nice. But who do you need to convince, them or me?" And that came to a realizing that millions of likes is not the 200,000K that a foundation can give you.
Mm-hmm.
And to advance, you advance with the 250,000K that a foundation would give you. But
mm-hmm.
the foundation will never give you 250K
right.
if you have not made your proof. I mean,
right. So there's two turfs that make themselves felt, and they're vying for power, for market share, if you like. And
yeah, yeah. Attention today. We live in
attention.
Attention is power
mm-hmm.
today.
Yeah. It's interesting. I have another question about pertaining to something we were talking over lunch. You said that the role of painting was to save a certain kind of reality, to redress order, to bring back justice, or it was something like that. It's an imperfect quotation, but how does one manage to keep one's artistic autonomy as an artist and be politically engaged? It seems like these two things are maybe in competition. Sometimes, often, I don't know if you want to speak a little bit about that.
Well, you're poor. in a way that if people want to use you, or let's use the word not manipulate you, but if people want to use you for their interest, and you are not willing to detach yourself from the quest of truth with a big T that you were saying before, in order to get money, then you're poor. It is actually the fact that I am not being financed by any lobby, not social democrats, not demo Christians, not Republicans, not Democrats, not populist. It's also what put me here, that made me legitimate, that made me credible, that made me, because if I was an artist and under my productions I would write Parti Socialiste Français or Parti Populaire Espagnol, then people would take my work as publicity, propaganda. And the difference between propaganda and art is very subtle. Because you have, for instance, there's a type of art that I really like. One of the inspirations I have is North Korean political propaganda art.
What's their name?
I don't know the name of the artist, but if you do any type of research on North Korean political art, you will see the type of image of image identity. Now, then the message that you portray is what makes the difference between. Can you say you're trying to reach out for this big common denominator truth and not to promote an ideology or a direction? And that's a very subtle thing. I think I do it kind of good because I also have the political sciences background. And so I don't make some mistakes that could be done easily if you don't know the subject well. Like that it could end up being a piece that it becomes a flag for extreme right or extreme left or anything like that.
What, in your view, is the role of the artist today?
Produce, also in the noble sense, to produce the history and captate and plasmate and fix history. And change and human behavior and creativity in a more vulgar way, content creators. And there is more and more time available for people for entertainment. And maybe if you can use entertainment to indirectly educate a bit, that's a good thing that I like to do, but it's not something that it's criticable that you just make entertainment content. So depends on what you want to do. You can be really good at making beautiful entertainment content, and that could be your mission, and it's not something that it's you're more or less than a Banksy or a Shepherd or a Sexto Maldonado. For me specifically, my mission that I gave upon myself, nobody, is that I wanted to leave behind two or three pieces of work, human work, that that people will say, well, this was the reality of some people time ago, history. Basically, painting history, painting the times. That's the easiest way I can say it. Painting the times. Because even Warhol, that you would not necessarily consider or see in superficially that his message is political or social or cultural, it was extremely political message what Warhol was doing, because he was mocking the true art and using art. he was mocking the consumption, le consumérisme, the consumption society, making pieces of arts which are supposed to be unique pieces, and making it series like in a factory, and selling each one as a, as a, an original was his way of taking revenge on the consumism and actually laughing on the consumism society. So he painted that. In more specifically, Guernica, that's more clear and it's more micro. Well, Picasso painted the first ever bombardment of a city of were only civilians in it. That was the very first time that a city was bombarded, so that was an historical breaking point in human history, even if it's just a specific thing from Spain, but it was something that had to do with the whole world. So even a painting like Batalla, which is specifically about Venezuela, it has in it some universality, because a woman awaiting a children with a gas mask. Well, that's something that anybody can understand in South Africa, in Lithuania, in Germany, whatever. So saying something and adding human creation. That's it. That's the role of the artist. It's since the time that they were in caves, painting animals, they wanted to leave something behind. Leave something behind. Yeah.
And what are you working on now?
Okay, right now I'm working on commissions, and I'm doing some pieces that are more intimate, to change. I like to change, because otherwise it becomes very heavy, and it's not always easy to produce pieces that have that much energy and invested in them. And I'm preparing works, because I am starting to get solicited for a lot of things, and I understand now that I have to have production, because if you get invited for expositions and stuff and you don't have pieces to show.
That's
so I'm working. I'm still in the working process.
Yeah.
Way, way far from having done most of what I have to do behind me. So I'm working on producing, and I'm also now working on starting to set up the coming into the market and the coming into exposure commercially, because I don't have a problem in understanding that getting paid for what you do it would take away credibility or legitimacy from your work. It's actually, the way I see it, it's the only way that I'll be free. You asked before,
right?
How can you be politically engaged and free? And well, I can only if I can live. If I have to depend on somebody's lobby's money, then I will have to paint according to what they expect. If I win my own money selling my pieces, so paradoxically, being very commercial is the only way that you're free, really free to paint what
to
you want.
To produce what you want,
Yeah.
And do you have gallery representation in the US? I think you said you did. Do you have anybody in Europe?
Well, here in Switzerland, I have a friend, yes. And in the US, I have two curator friends. And the next important expositions will be in the US.
Okay, great.
Starting next year.
Fantastic.
That's where when I left Switzerland 4 years ago, and I started started selling better, my main client base was here in Switzerland, because I know a lot of people here in Switzerland, but it's been switching to the US. Specifically because the type of art that I do is very modern, pop art, contemporary, and it has more difficulty being attached to conservative and old school, let's say, like way spaces and countries. And also when you're in advance, when you have a vision, when you're having a when you have a vision, in general, you're in counter tempo with the evolution. I'm a bit in advance. That's why I'm appreciated, because I'm doing what people are not a lot of people took into themselves into doing.
Yeah.
This will be probably a vogue in a few years or something like that. So, yeah, setting up. I don't remember exactly the question because I digressed.
No, you answered it very effectively. So thank you again for speaking to me in this podcast, for presenting a Meet the Artist lecture, which was very much appreciated. You saw how many people were in the room. Yeah. And I hope, you have more in store here at Webster for tomorrow. You have a whole
Inshallah.
Schedule. Yeah.
Buddha and I talk with Wood too. Not to leave anybody outside. Yeah, well, thank you very much. And yeah, tomorrow I will come back. This was it was beautiful for me to share my knowledge and my experience with the kids from Webster, because they better than a lot of people can understand it. So it was I felt like a real win-win, and an opportunity to let them know and prepare themselves for this type of new realities, which will be most certainly instruments that they will have to use in the future. Not necessarily as being as an artist, but developing yourself in an independent career, or right. working for or any type of institutional or private or public organization. These are skill sets and filters to understand the world that will be useful. And it was really made me really feel happy that I could be useful for them too.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.